the 29th installment of the Holocaust Lecture Series at Vanderbilt University. It is the longest running such series in the United States and in North America in large part because of the great number of people who attend its lectures, its films, and its events. And so I'd like to begin by thanking all of you here for joining us tonight. An old history professor once told me that history is like an old photograph or painting that hangs crooked on a wall. A student of history will spend his or her entire life in the hopes of approaching that old photograph and nudging it with great care, ever so slightly, centering it. The Holocaust Lecture Series works towards a similar goal, and some would say that it is an unattainable goal. To study the Holocaust in all its dimensions, in all its perspectives, so that we can all look upon that old photograph one day and find it hanging somewhat straight, no matter where we stand. This is what motivated the planning committee to select as this year's theme cultural genocide. Our journey began in October with a trip to the United States Holocaust Museum in Washington. Our discussions of genocide took us to Guatemala, Hungary, and Darfur. And on that journey, we have walked in the presence of Holocaust survivors and those who have witnessed mass terror from Germany to Rwanda. We have seen genocide from the eyes of writers, playwrights, and doctors on stage and on screen. And in our final lecture of the series tonight, we come full circle. We return to the place where so many perished, and we listen to a story, a version, perhaps, that we have not yet heard. The story of the cultural genocide that took place in Poland under Nazi and Soviet occupation should resonate deeply within these walls of academia. For it is a story about the wholesale destruction of professors, doctors, lawyers, writers, clergy, and above all, it is the story of the destruction of promising youth. We have with us a scholar from a faraway country who has traveled quite a distance to be here in many ways. Professor Piotr Wrubel holds the Konstanty Reiner Chair of Polish Studies at the University of Toronto. Prior to his appointment in 1994, he taught at the University of Warsaw, at the University of Michigan, Michigan State University, and the University of California. He obtained his PhD from the University of Warsaw in 1984. He has been a visiting scholar at the Institute of European History in Mainz, at Humboldt University in Berlin, at the Institute of Polish Jewish Studies at Oxford, and at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. He was a research fellow at the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, and in the late 1980s served as research director of a clandestine Eastern archive which collected materials on the Polish people deported to the Soviet Union after 1939. He has authored or co-authored about 50 scholarly articles and 9 books, most recently a book published in 2006 entitled Nation and History, Polish Historians from the Enlightenment to the Second World War. He serves on the Advisory Board of Poland, a Journal of Polish Jewish Studies, on the Board of Directors of the Polish Jewish Heritage Foundation of Canada, on the Governing Council of the American Association for Polish Jewish Studies. Please join me in welcoming Professor Piotr Wrubel as tonight's guest speaker.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for inviting me here. Thank you very much for coming. And thank you very much for your kind introduction. For many reasons, it is difficult to talk about World War II in Poland during a Holocaust lecture series. To most Americans, World War II is the proverbial ancient history, vague and remote. Leaving aside the D-Day, Pearl Harbor, and some episodes of the Pacific War, the last global conflict is mostly unknown and almost irrelevant in contemporary America. For most East Europeans, however, including the Poles, the war is a vivid memory. The emotional wounds are still fresh, and serious consequences rooted in the World War II tragedy continue to affect Eastern Europe. The Yugoslav War of the early 1990s is the best example of this phenomenon. In addition, World War II in Poland is a huge topic, and it is hardly possible to give its comprehensive picture during one lecture. Therefore, I can only signalize the most important issues, which is problematic too. In his Holocaust Encyclopedia, Walter Laqueur opens the entry on Poles and Jews in World War II in the following way. I quote, "The question of the attitude of the non-Jewish Polish population, hereafter Poles, towards the Jews during World War II is highly controversial, if not explosive. It is impossible to reduce the relationship of the Poles to the Jews to a one-sided assertion. All broad generalizations are bound to be not only false, but also unjust." End of quote. And yet, a history of World War II, as seen by many Poles and Jews, including American Poles and American Jews, is based on generalizations and stereotypes. Jews and Poles have established secular civic religions based on specific interpretations of their past. Biased understandings of World War II, frequently mutually exclusive, constitute important parts of these two civic religions and the national identities of Poles and Jews. Often, both groups do not know much about each other. At the same time, representatives of both these nations are involved in a peculiar competition: who suffered more and who should be better compensated for this suffering. Not infrequently, Poles and Jews accuse each other of a theft of suffering. As a scholar, I do not want to participate in a competition of victims, and I have no doubt concerning the Polish and Jewish history during World War II. According to the Nazi plans, all the Jews were to be murdered, and at the same time, in spite of all, at least temporarily, a part of the Polish nation was supposed to live. And indeed, the Jews practically ceased to exist in Poland, while the Poles did survive the war and are still a big and dynamic nation. On the other hand, however, the Holocaust did overshadow many aspects of World War II in Poland. Frequently, even the most important statesmen and intellectuals confused the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising of 1943 with the 1944 rising in Warsaw, much larger, more destructive, and far more important from the military point of view. Moreover, it is difficult to understand the suffering of the Jews during World War II if we eliminate a history of non-Jewish people from our analysis. Many scholars believe, therefore, that the study of the Holocaust by itself is too narrow and too restrictive. After 1939, the entire population of Poland became a victim of the Nazi German genocide. True, Poles and Jews were, to use Gutmann's and Krakowski's term, unequal victims. Most Polish Jews were murdered, and the Polish Jewish community was completely destroyed. Christian Poles were supposed to be transformed into a class of slaves working for the Third Reich. To achieve this, the Germans planned to murder the elites of the Polish nation and to a big extent they succeeded in doing that. Between 1939 and 1941, the Germans were helped in their anti-Polish genocidal operation by their Soviet ally, who later continued murderous actions against the Poles, Polish elites, on its own. As a result, after World War II and the post-war period of the direct Soviet occupation, the Polish nation reappeared deeply wounded and almost deprived of its leading class. Because of it, it was difficult to the Poles to resist the Sovietization of their country, and, speaking with only some exaggeration, the consequences of this decapitation of the nation are still visible in Poland today. Rafael Lemkin, a Polish Jewish lawyer, a public prosecutor in the courts of interwar Poland, and an officer of the Polish army in 1939, the father of the term genocide, defined it as the destruction of a nation or of an ethnic group. He supplemented this short statement with the following explanation. I quote, "Generally speaking, genocide does not necessarily mean the immediate destruction of a nation, except when accomplished by mass killings of all members of a nation. It is intended rather to signify a coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of essential foundations of the life of national groups, with the aim of annihilating the groups themselves. The objectives of such a plan would be disintegration of the political and social institutions, of culture, language, national feelings, religion, and the economic existence of national groups, and the destruction of the personal security, liberty, health, dignity, and even the lives of individuals belonging to such groups." End of quote. This definition, accepted officially for legal purposes by the United Nations, fits perfectly to the Polish case during World War II. We can even suspect that it was modeled on Poland's experience under the German occupation. Describing techniques of genocide in various fields, political, social, economic, biological, physical, religious, and moral, Lemkin constantly used Polish examples and returned several times to an aspect of German attacks against the Polish people, which can be called a cultural genocide. I quote, "The focal point of this attack has been the intelligentsia, because this group largely provides national leadership and organizes resistance against Nazification. This is especially true in Poland and Slovenia, where the intelligentsia and the clergy were in great part removed from the rest of the population and deported for forced labor in Germany." And then Lemkin added, "Moreover, in the Polish areas, Polish youth were excluded from the benefit of liberal arts studies and were channeled predominantly into the trade schools. The occupant apparently believes that the study of liberal arts may develop independent national Polish thinking, and therefore he tends to prepare Polish youth for the role of skilled labor to be employed in German industries. Not only have national creative activities in the cultural and artistic field been rendered impossible by regimentation, but the population has also been deprived of inspiration from existing cultural and artistic values. Thus, especially in Poland, where national monuments destroyed and libraries, archives, museums, and galleries of art carried away." End of quote. Several times before World War II, Hitler explained to his collaborators that the coming conflict would not be a regular war. This was supposed to be a permanent broadening of the Reich's borders, an extension of the German Lebensraum, and the beginning of the Germanization of the East. Hitler wanted the German forces to devastate Poland so thoroughly that it could not be taken into account as a political factor for the next few decades. "Have no pity," Hitler told the commanders of the German army during a meeting in late August 1939. The generals were ordered to act with the greatest brutality and without mercy. Then the conquest of the new territories was supposed to be followed by an ethnic cleansing directed against the Jews and the Poles. After this, what Hitler called ethnische Flurbereinigung, an ethnic floor cleaning, the conquered areas were supposed to be colonized by German settlers. To achieve these goals, Hitler planned a removal of Polish Führungsschicht, the Polish leading class. Hitler's scenario was realized in September 1939 when, I quote Alexander Rossino here, the German army and SS conducted the Polish campaign with a viciousness that was unprecedented in the annals of European conflict up to this point. The Wehrmacht was followed by seven Einsatzgruppen, which concentrated on the annihilation of the so-called deutschfeindliche Elemente, groups of population hostile towards the Germans, or, in other words, members of local elites, active politically and socially, socialists, intellectuals, members of the nobility, the clergy, and the Jews. 17 days after the German attack against Poland, the Soviets followed suit. The Red Army also had special units looking for and persecuting Polish elites. In early October 1939, when the Polish campaign was over, Poland was divided between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union according to the Ribbentrop-Molotov Agreement, almost exactly 50% of the Polish territory to the Germans and 50% to the Soviets. To show you a map, I prepared some transparencies, and here is a map of Europe. Here is a map of Europe before, Central Europe, before the war. You can see Poland in the middle between the Soviet Union and Germany. And here is a map illustrating how the Germans and the Soviets, how the Germans and the Soviets divided Poland. Well, maybe it's not quite sharp, but so you can see here, this is the Soviet part of the deal, and this is the German part of the deal. Over there, there is the Baltic Sea. Here is Czechoslovakia, or actually remnants of Czechoslovakia. So the Germans divided their share into two parts. Several Polish western provinces were incorporated directly into the Reich, and former central Poland was transformed into the general government for the occupied Polish territories, later called simply general government. In October 1939, Hitler met Hans Frank, the new general governor, and introduced him and instructed him on how to deal with the territories under Frank's supervision. I quote, "Poland should be treated as a colony," said Hitler, "and the Poles should be slaves of the Großdeutschen Weltreichs, Great German World Reich." Frank agreed with his fear. "The Poles," said the governor later, "do not need universities and secondary schools. The Polish lands are to be changed into an intellectual desert." In November 1939, the racial political office of the Nazi Party prepared a special document on the Germanization policy towards Poland's population. The document emphasized that the entire Polish intelligentsia, described as, I quote, Polish priests, teachers, physicians, dentists, veterinarians, army officers, high administration officials, rich merchants, big landowners, writers, journalists, and all the people with high school or university education, should be removed from the territories incorporated into the Reich until the end of 1939 in the newly established German province of Danzig-Westpreußen, which included the former city of Danzig and pre-war Polish Pomerania. The Germans killed about 30,000 Poles. In Warteland, former Greater Poland or Wielkopolska, about 10,000 Poles were killed. Until the spring of 1941, about 460,000 Polish citizens, including practically the entire local intelligentsia and all the Jews, were deported from the Polish territories incorporated directly into the Reich to the general government. Many people died during this operation or shortly after it, exposed to bad weather and hunger. All the Polish cultural and scholarly institutions in the Western territories were closed. The facilities of the University of Poznań were used to establish a new Reichsuniversität Poznań. In the incorporated territories, the German authorities removed all the public notices and inscriptions in Polish. They Germanized Polish place names and banished the Polish language from public use, including the church. Frequently, people who spoke Polish in the streets were insulted and beaten. The Poles who were allowed to stay in Pomerania, Greater Poland, the Lodz area, and Silesia were reduced to a class of slaves during the first 2 years of the war. The Germans became afraid, however, that dumping hundreds of thousands of Poles into the general government might transform this German colony into a strong Polish national center. To prevent it, the German occupational forces started the so-called Intelligenzaktion, later known as Außerordentliche Befriedigungsaktion, also directed against the Polish elites and Polish cultural heritage. All Polish artistic, scientific, and educational institutions, with the exception of simplified primary schools, were closed in the general government. The Germans destroyed numerous monuments, historical buildings, scientific and art collections, and libraries. Most museums, public and private art collections, archives, and scientific laboratories were pillaged. Many outstanding German scholars were involved in the robbery of the cultural heritage of Poland. The publication of Polish books was forbidden, and the Polish press, numbering over 2,200 titles before the war, was reduced, leaving aside the underground press, to a few dozen periodicals fully controlled by the Germans. The bookstores were forbidden to sell English and French books, dictionaries and handbooks. A list of about 3,000 forbidden books was published, and the mere possession of these publications was illegal. The occupational authorities did their best to lower the intellectual and the moral level of Polish society, to corrupt and demoralize it, to promote drunkenness and collaboration. To achieve these goals, the Germans did not hesitate to use terror against the civilian population. In early November 1939, Hans Frank announced that the German police would execute one person per every house on which a poster commemorating the pre-war holiday of November 11 would appear. In the spring of 1940, Heinrich Himmler decided that 20,000 Poles should be sent to concentration camps. On July 14, 1940, the first transport of Polish political prisoners arrived in Auschwitz, which for the next year and a half contained mostly Poles. At the beginning of the war, the Jews were not the priority of the Nazi killing machine in Poland. They were persecuted, and about 7,000 of them were killed in pogrom-like situations until early 1940. But the German systematic extermination operation, especially in Western Poland, was directed against Polish elites. The most shocking action against the best and brightest Poles took place in November 1939 in Kraków, or Krakow. The Germans arranged an opening of a new academic year at the Jagiellonian University, when its professors and their colleagues from Krakow's mining academy gathered in the university main hall. The Nazis arrested 183 scholars and sent them to the Sachsenhausen concentration camp. A part of the arrested professors perished in the camp. Some died immediately after their release, and some survived but were unable to continue any scholarly activities. Old buildings and sophisticated laboratories were devastated by the Germans. At the same time, all the other educational and scholarly institutions, such as universities, high schools, libraries, museums, archives, and research institutes, were closed in general government. Polish intellectuals fell into deep poverty, and many of them never returned to their pre-war intellectual activities. Polish children were allowed to attend only primary schools of four grades to be able, as Himmler put it, to count to 500 and to write down their names. In February 1940, Völkischer Beobachter, the press organ of the Nazi Party, published an interview with Hans Frank. "Today," he said, "big red posters appeared in Prague to announce an execution of seven Czechs. The forests of Poland," continued Frank, "would not be large enough to produce a sufficient amount of paper if I wanted to print one poster for every seven Poles executed in general government." A similar policy was introduced in the Polish territories occupied by the Soviet Union. Stalin shared Hitler's views on the distinctive nature of the war that was being waged. I quote, "This war is not as in the past," he explained his opinions to a Yugoslav communist, Milovan Žilas. "Whoever occupies a territory also imposes on it his own social system. Everyone imposes his own social system as far as his army can reach. It cannot be otherwise," end of quote. And so, Eastern Poland was divided between the Soviet Belarusian and Ukrainian republics and depolonized. The new authorities destroyed Polish monuments, removed Polish street signs, and closed Polish bookstores, publishing houses, and newspapers. Ukrainian and Belarusian became the language of instruction in most schools and universities. Russian became compulsory. Polish pre-war textbooks were removed, the teaching of religion was banned, and religious life was paralyzed. The campaign against Polish culture was presented as a rebuilding of Belarusian and Ukrainian cultures unfairly suppressed by the Poles. Soviet propaganda showed the Polish population of the former Polish eastern provinces as a small group of colonizers and exploiters, although out of 13 million people living in the territories occupied by the Soviets, the Poles numbered 5 million, the Ukrainians 4.5, the Belarusians 1.5, and the Jews 1.5 million. The Soviets imprisoned tens of thousands of Poles and deported about 500,000 people to Siberia and to the other remote parts of the Soviet Empire. The first deportation of February 1940 was dominated by military and civilian settlers, rewarded with land for their service to the Polish state, and forestry and state employees all categories with their closest relatives. The second deportation in April 1940 consisted mainly of army officers, policemen, landowners, teachers, businessmen, politicians of all non-communist parties, lawyers, ex-members of the Communist Party of Poland, rich peasants, administration employees of big estates, people from the border areas, and the families of the people arrested individually, and of the Polish prisoners of war kept in the three infamous camps of Kozielsk, Starobielsk, and Ostrowów. In June 1940, during the third deportation, the Soviets deported mostly refugees from German-occupied Poland. In May 1941, the Soviet authorities started the last fourth deportation before the German aggression of June 41. This time, a list of deportees included, I quote, active members of counter-revolutionary organizations, such as Teachers Union, Riflemen's Association, Scouts, all with their families, military gendarmes, policemen, security guards, prison warders, and if aggravating circumstances were confirmed, which almost always took place, landowners, merchants, storekeepers, industrialists, former Polish state officials, retired officers, refugees from Germany, and criminals. In April and May 1940, the NKVD murdered over 21,000 Polish officers in Katyn near Smolensk and in several other places. Most of the victims were officers of reserve and scholars or professionals during the peacetime. In Katyn alone, where over 4,200 officers were executed, 21 university professors, 300 physicians, and hundreds of lawyers, teachers, and engineers were killed. The cultural policies of the Soviet authorities towards their occupied territories seem to suggest that a wholesale deportation of the Poles had not been planned between 39 and 41. Yet, the Soviet occupiers destroyed a significant part of the Polish cultural heritage in the borderlands, especially if particular objects were related to the Catholic Church, the institution of the Polish state, or the landowning class. Most of the Polish pre-39 cultural organizations were dissolved or depolonized. The pre-war elites were systematically destroyed. A group of Soviet artists, scholars, writers, and cultural activists were sent from the pre-39 Soviet territories. Only some Polish institutions and elements of Polish culture were preserved. The Polish chairs existed at the State University of Lviv, the pre-war John Kazimierz University, now completely reorganized and Ukrainized. The Political University of Lviv preserved some of its pre-war Polish character. About 200 Polish writers gathered in Lviv and formed their own organization. Several communist newspapers and periodicals in Polish were published in the incorporated territories. Several radio programs were broadcasted in Polish. A group of cultural associations were allowed to work. Polish language books were printed, and some Polish language theaters and publishing houses were tolerated. All of them, however, were instruments of the intensive communist indoctrination and were located in the regions, towns, and cities where the Poles constituted either a majority of population or a very strong minority. The German attack against the Soviet Union in June 1941 and the following month marked a visible change in the Nazi policies towards Poland and Eastern Europe in general. The general government colonial system of the first war years was replaced with brutal terror and extermination. The so-called racial experts of the Nazi Party estimated in 1939 that next to over 3 million Jews, Poland was inhabited by about 1 million converts from Judaism to Christianity and about 1.5 million people coming from mixed marriages. The Nazi leaders decided to murder this group of approximately 6 million people. The Jews of Poland had been persecuted from the beginning of the war. The first ghettos were established in October 1939. In November 1940, the large ghetto of Warsaw was sealed. The Jews were tortured, robbed, and starved to death. In 1942 and 43, during the German victorious military operations in Russia and after the change of German policies, most Polish Jews were killed, mainly in the Nazi extermination camps of Auschwitz, Treblinka, Majdanek, Chełmno, Sobibór, and Bełżec. Altogether, the Germans exterminated approximately 3 million Jewish citizens of Poland and 3 million Jews brought to occupied for Poland from abroad. Throughout many centuries, the Jews contributed to Poland's economy and culture. Thousands of Polish Jewish professionals, writers, scholars, physicians, musicians, and artists helped to build the Polish national heritage and fortune. Because a number of Poles helped the Germans to exterminate the Jews, and because the killing took place on Polish soil, post-war Poland inherited a most difficult legacy. As a result of the war, other Polish national minorities also disappeared. A long tradition of Polish multinational and multicultural society came to a tragic end. In late 1941, the Nazi main office of Reich's security prepared the so-called General Plan East. The plan presented the long-time goals of German policies in Eastern Europe, which was supposed to be transformed into a huge German settlement region. The plan also included scenarios for particular East European nations. The Jews were supposed to be totally exterminated. Between 80 and 85% of the Poles would be deported to Siberia, a kind of German protectorate after the final fall of the Soviet Union. About 3 or 4 million Polish Untermenschen, subhumans, were supposed to be kept as slaves in former Poland. About 3% of the Polish population was considered suitable for Germanization. Among the Czechs, for instance, this group represented 50% of population. Ultimately, most slaves were destined for extermination through labor or for deportation to the East. Even though the Nazi leadership intended to put the General Plan East into reality after the victorious end of the war, the first elements of this criminal vision were introduced in 1942 and 43. In the Zamość region, southeast of Lublin, an area of good soil, the Germans deported inhabitants of hundreds of Polish villages to concentration camps and replaced the local population with German settlers. This is, by the way, why the present president of Germany was born in the Zamość region. Altogether, about 2 million people were sent from Poland to Germany to work in the military industry. More than 200,000 Polish children were kidnapped and taken to the Reich for Germanization. Most of them have never been recovered. German terror and exploitation provoked resistance. The Poles had started organizing anti-German secret organizations and an underground state immediately after the September defeat. To quote John Keegan, probably the most outstanding historian of World War II, the Poles, I quote, produced few collaborators and no puppet chief, a unique distinction in the record of European response to German aggression, end of quote. Soon, the underground state in Poland established communication lines with the Polish government in exile, first in France, then in London. Working in secrecy, Polish political parties succeeded in uniting the armed underground into the Home Army in 1943. The Home Army reached 380,000 organized and sworn resistance fighters, the largest anti-German underground army in occupied Europe. The Polish underground state included also a clandestine civilian administration, secret educational institutions, and justice system. During the first years of the war, the Polish underground refrained from direct anti-German military operations to avoid German retribution and civilian casualties. After 1941, however, this policy was unfeasible. The Nazi terror brought huge casualties anyway and provoked spontaneous resistance. The Home Army had to control and to coordinate this resistance. In addition, in early 1943, the Soviets discontinued diplomatic relations with the Polish government in exile, and in January 1944, they crossed the pre-war border of Poland. In July 1944, Moscow established a Soviet-sponsored Polish communist puppet state in East Central Poland. In late July 1944, the Red Army units appeared in Warsaw's eastern suburbs. On August 1st, 1944, the Home Army started an uprising in Warsaw to eject the Germans and to form an independent Polish political center in Warsaw. At this point, the Red Army deliberately stopped its offensive and remained idle. The Soviet Air Force, so active over Warsaw earlier, suddenly disappeared from the skies, allowing the Germans to bomb the city unrestrained. The Red Army not only stopped its advance, but also disarmed detachments of the Home Army marching to Warsaw, and the Soviet government refused to allow the Western Allies to use Soviet air bases to airlift supplies to the fighting Poles. For their part, the Germans sent fresh strong units to Warsaw. On October 2nd, 1944, after 63 days of desperate fighting, the uprising surrendered. The Home Army command and about 12,000 insurgents were taken as prisoners of war. The Germans deported the remainder of the city's population to various camps and almost completely destroyed the city. Over 200,000 civilians died. About 18,000 Home Army soldiers were killed and about 7,000 wounded. The main body of the Home Army was eliminated. The best representatives of the Polish youth of Warsaw, almost the entire generation, perished. When the Red Army took the Polish capital in January 1945, the city was nothing but a deserted ruin. Warsaw was destroyed to such an extent, over 80% of its buildings lay in ruins, that many politicians and architects doubted it could ever be rebuilt. The defeat of the uprising weakened the organized resistance in Poland, enabling the Soviets to establish their political domination over the country. Poland's fate was confirmed at the Yalta Conference in February 1945. For the next 45 years, Poland was a part of the outer Soviet Empire. As a result of the war, Poland lost half of its pre-war territory. Here is a map showing the shifting borders again. Okay. So Poland lost, as a result of the war, Poland lost a half of its pre-war territory. True, Poland was partially compensated with German eastern provinces, and one may rightly say that Silesia or the Baltic Sea coast were much more developed than the eastern borderlands. Yet, out of five main cultural centers of pre-war Poland, Warsaw, Krakow, Poznań, Vilna, and Lwów, Poland lost two, Vilna and Lwów. Warsaw was completely destroyed, Poznań was ethnically cleansed, and Kraków paid a price too for being the capital of general government. In 1947, The Polish Office of War Reparation estimated that Poland lost 6,028,000 citizens during the war. The number became an official one, but now we know for sure that it was not accurate. The Reparation Office counted only ethnic Polish and Jewish victims. Other minorities and casualties in eastern borderlands were ignored. It is almost certain, therefore, that the actual number of Polish citizens who perished during the war was significantly higher. In 1939, before the war, Poland had slightly over 35 million citizens. The first census of 46 showed 23.9 million people living in Poland, a difference of almost 12 million people who escaped from Poland or were killed or deported. Among the missing people, intelligentsia constituted a large segment. Altogether, during World War II, Poland lost about 50,000 intellectuals and professionals. 45% of Poland's physicians and dentists, both Christian and Jewish, 57% of its lawyers, over 15% of its teachers, 40% of university professors, and over 18% of its clergy. In other words, 37% of all the Polish university graduates perished, 37%. Polish universities lost 42% of their buildings and 70% of equipment. About 85% of library collections, 30% of theaters, 75% of movie theaters, 70% of museums, and 100% of publishing houses were destroyed. The war brought an overwhelming cultural degradation to Poland. It was a ruined country in 1945. Its per capita destruction was unmatched anywhere in the world. Almost 40% of the entire productive capacity and two-thirds of the industrial base of Poland was destroyed. The transportation system was practically inoperable. The agricultural production had fallen catastrophically. Millions of Poles decided to stay abroad, afraid to return to the Soviet-occupied country. The deserted Polish cities were recovering slowly, populated by peasants coming from countryside. All these came with a desperate psychological context. The Soviet Union lost millions too, but the sacrifice turned the USSR into one of the two world's superpowers. The British and Americans could believe that their soldiers had not died in vain. The Germans and the Japanese had someone to blame for their catastrophe. But the Poles, wrote Norman Davies, whose death toll was the greatest of all, had to mourn without comfort or consolation. Unlike the Russians, they could take no pride in the power and glory of the military triumph or in the stamina of the socialist order. Unlike the Anglo-Americans, they could not look to survival of pre-war freedom and democracy. Unlike the Germans or Japanese, they could not even blame their leaders, since the Polish government had not started the war and had not abandoned the struggle. Poland's dead had perished honorably, but to no obviously worthwhile effect. On the last day of July 1945, the American ambassador to Poland, Arthur Bliss Lane, landed in Warsaw. This was not his first visit to the capital of Poland. I quote, "I was remembering the Warsaw," he recalled in his memoirs, "I had known and loved in years long gone by. I had seen Warsaw first in 1919, when Poland had just arisen as a free nation, after 125 years of subjugation. One then sensed on the streets of its capital a gaiety of the soul, an intoxicating sense of freedom never felt before. I had seen Warsaw again in 1937, when it was one of the most beautiful capitals of all Europe. But now my heart grew heavier with every mile. I could see only a handful of houses left unharmed. All others were bombed or gutted by fire. The smoky smell of long dead fires hung in the air. The sickening sweet odor of burned human flesh was a grim warning that we were entering a city of the dead, wrote Bliss Lane. There was no sense of real freedom and joy in any city of Poland in 1945. To a big extent, this was the country of the dead. Thank you very much. Please have questions. I would love if someone disagreed with my opinions. Go ahead.
Okay, so I have a question regarding Germany's policy nowadays.
Yes.
I mean the Steinbach idea. And how do you feel about it? How do you feel about the center of German citizens that were defiled from Poland?
I feel very bad about it. I feel very bad about it. Because nowadays, Germans portray their World War history sometimes in such a way that it's kind of similar to the Holocaust story. You know, those people burned alive in the bombed cities of Germany, those people suffocating in the cellars of German cities, and there are those tones comparable to the Holocaust story. You see, my point is that in Eastern Europe, history is very important in terms of national consciousness. We based our identity on history, Poles, Jews, Germans, etc. And we create mythologies, we create legends. And the Germans have their legend too. And this is very, very dangerous because people of Western Poland who live here feel kind of unsafe that one day something may happen, that maybe the Germans would be able to buy this or would be able to control this in any way. So all these actions like this one, like Erika Steinbach's initiative, does not help to create healthy Polish-German relationship. Nowadays, I'm sorry to say, Polish-German relations are bad, worse than in the 90s, and we have to blame both sides for this. I mean, not only the Germans, but Poles are to blame as well. And I worry about this, and the center refugees or deported people showing first of all the Germans is something I'm strongly against. This is my answer. All right, come on. There was something you don't like. I'm absolutely certain. Go ahead. Well, the EU, of course, should mediate, should help. But as you know, next year the Germans will be in charge, which probably will not help. Although, you know, so yes, my short answer is that the EU should help. But I'm afraid the EU is overwhelmed. Now they will deal with Romania and Bulgaria. There is this discussion about Ukraine and Turkey. And the entire concept does not really work perfectly. In addition, Central European nationalists, including Polish nationalists, try to undermine the entire concept. Okay, so this is very difficult. But you see, there is one thing here, since we are talking about the Germans, that like Polish-Jewish relations, also German-Polish relations were very, very difficult. And here, talking about World War II, I said a lot of bad things about the Germans. And this is kind of typical for the Polish people. But we have to remember that, to be honest, Polish people, I mean, like it or dislike it, Polish people nowadays is a mixture of Slavic and Germanic people. Because especially during the so-called German colonization in the Middle Ages, a huge amount of Germans came to Poland. I mean, at that time, they didn't have one German identity. There were Saxons, Schwabs, etc., but still. And then the Germans were coming. So the Poles nowadays, in my opinion, constitute a kind of a mixture. There is a saying, scratch a Russian and you will have a Tatar, scratch a Pole and you will have a German. And it is so, really, and it is very, very complicated. This morning I had a conversation about this. You see, talking about the Jews. There were Jews in Poland who tried to hide their identity after World War II, after 45, right? Because sometimes it wasn't not that safe to be Jewish, especially in the late 40s. So even now, 50 years later, there are people in Poland who remember that actually they are of Jewish background, but they don't talk too much about this. This is not quite healthy. To make things more complicated, the same thing applies to the Germans too. And this is my story. I mean, I said a lot of bad things about the Germans, and to some extent I did it deliberately, because I don't like this way the Nazis did this, the Nazis did that. Because quite frequently, especially young people, don't know who are the Nazis. The Nazis, Martians, the Germans. The Germans did it. But this is difficult and complicated. My mother was German too, okay? My mother is from a German family which came to Poland in the mid-19th century and settled in Łódź, or if you prefer, Lodz. They Polonized, they changed their last name, my mother's family. And in 1939, when the Germans came to Łódź or Lodz, they were very well informed. And they approached my grandfather and they said, Herr von Stahl, we know that in fact you are not really Stachlewski, you are von Stahl. This is the Volksliste. Sign it. My grandfather was Polish in, I guess, second or third generation. And he said, no way. The Germans took all his daughters, including my mother, to camps in Germany, to labor camps. This was a bilingual family still, because this so-called Lodzermenschen constitute a kind of a community in Łódź. There was a Jewish community, German community, and Polish community in Łódź. So the Lodzermenschen still spoke German and Polish, and so my mother. And my mother spent the entire war in German labor camp. Initially in 40-41 it was bearable. In 43-44 it was really, really, really tough. And it's really difficult to find a person more anti-German than my mother, even though she was born in such a family. So this is very, very complicated, and it's very important to emphasize this, that things are not that easy. Same thing with the Soviets. I said some harsh things about the Soviets, or including the Russians. This is very complicated too, because like most members of the Polish intelligentsia, I really like Russian culture. Russian language is beautiful. Russian literature is absolutely fantastic. Dostoevsky is the best writer ever, no doubt about it. But at the same time, it would be difficult to convince me that the Soviet system was good, even for the Russians. It was not good. So this is so complicated, and because of this, this is so interesting and difficult. And usually, I need a year at least to explain this to my students. This evening I had 45 minutes. I did my best, but I know that this was just a short message, and I know that because of this shortness, you can disagree with some statements. Yes, ma'am.
Both of my parents are Polish Holocaust survivors, and a story that my father tells is about his family who lived in a small town outside of Częstochowa, a family that had extensive landholdings, and a family that never returned, except for my father. And my question is, leading to the issue of Polish reparations, the because my father's family was annihilated. He was the only survivor. And he's wondered many times about the process of returning to Poland and capturing the land that his family once owned. So talk about, I guess the point I'm asking you about is responsibility and the issue of Polish reparations.
Very difficult issue. I mean, if you want to know my personal opinion is that your father's property should go to your father as soon as possible, because private property should return to legal owners, no doubt about it, Jewish or not Jewish, no matter what. In practical terms, however, it's not that easy for many reasons. Reason number one is that everything changed over there, and this property changed hands many, many, many times as well. People invested in this property. It's very difficult to return this piece of land. It's very difficult practically. Well, there are many people who dislike this idea, simply, generally, and they don't want to support it. And finally, you know, there is another argument. Look at this map. I'm thinking in simple Polish way, the way simple Poles think about it. You see, these territories, which belonged to Poland for a very, very long time, are now in Ukraine and Belarus, previously in the Soviet Union. There was private property over there too, right? Including my grandparents' private property, somewhere here east, southeast of Lwów or Lviv. And the Polish person thinks in the following way: there is no chance whatsoever that we regain anything from here. Why should we give anything to other people from outside? This is their thinking, how they think. And finally, I mean, returning to these practical issues, let me give you another example. You see, there is a Polish tradition of national uprisings. Every generation, a bloody, terrible uprising. And so there was a huge anti-Russian uprising in Poland in 1863. They were fighting like crazy for several years in forest, etc., etc. Eventually, the Russians suppressed the uprising. Many nobles were involved in the uprising, and they lost their property because the Russians took their property. Some of them survived till 1918, when New Poland reappeared on the map of Europe. And they approached the government of Poland and said, listen, we lost our property because we were the best Polish patriots fighting against the Russians. Please give us our estates back. And even then, with the Poles, with Polish patriots, it was impossible, because these estates changed hands many times, were divided, developed, change, etc., etc. They got almost nothing, some kind of minimal reparations. So returning to my initial answer, my private opinion, and many people in Poland share this opinion, is that your father should return his property back, no doubt about it. But practically, it's very difficult, and probably he will not get it back. This is my guess. Yes, sir.
What's the current climate, and how would you characterize the relationship between Poland and Russia?
not good, at least. You see, I don't want to blame Russia exclusively or Vladimir Putin exclusively, even though he is a nice candidate to be blamed for many, many things, right? But also, there is some responsibility on the Polish side right now. We have a government in Poland right now which, in my opinion, and I guess most Polish intellectuals would share this opinion, is not the best possible government we could have. And the Kaczyński brothers, the president, the prime minister, do not contribute to any improvement of Polish-German or Polish-Russian relations. And this is a very interesting phenomenon, and paradoxical as well, because the Kaczyński's brother belonged to a kind of a Polish intelligentsia, which was persecuted and suppressed during the communist period. So they could not travel abroad, they could not study foreign languages, they could not learn the world. And paradoxically, guys like the former president, post-communist president Kwaśniewski or Cimoszewicz or other guys, the communists before 89, they did travel abroad all the time. The best stipends in the United States went to them. And so they speak English. So they are experienced international politicians. And those Polish intelligentsia members who were conservative, traditional, patriotic, Catholic, did not have this opportunity. And as a result, we have people like the Kaczyński's brother, who are afraid of anything foreign, who are uninterested in anything foreign, who have a disastrous Minister of Foreign Affairs, a disastrous. And foreign affairs is a really serious problem right now in Berlin. If you add to this Vladimir Putin and his policies and his behavior, we have a very bad situation. And this is not the end of this story, because I hope nothing terrible will happen in Poland. But you will see, please remember my words, terrible things will happen in Russia during the next 10, 15 years or so. Because the Russian society is going through a deep social crisis. They are losing 1 million people a year, the society is sick, there will be a kind of explosion, a kind of a social serious problem, and this problem will affect Europe, Poland as well. And this is too bad that the Polish government is unable to find a kind of a compromise, especially that, as I said, Polish intelligentsia basically likes Russian culture and Russian language. Russian was compulsory when I was at school, when I was at the university. Russian was compulsory. We had to study Russian. But at the same time, we enjoyed some fragments of this. And I remember there was an exchange between Polish universities and Soviet universities. Students of my university, Warsaw University, used to go to Moscow. And we terrified our Russian hosts with Russian songs we used to sing. After a bottle of vodka or more, we started singing Russian songs. And remember a song about Chapayev with words like Россия, эх, Россия, великая земля, такая мала Польша победила тебя. Russia, Russia, you big country, such a small Poland defeated you in 1920. our Soviet hosts were terrified. I mean, they thought what to do with us. So we had this kind of love and hate relationship with Russia. We feel, Polish people, we feel fine in Russia. I mean, Russian culture is the culture we like. Open, friendly, emotional, vodka, things like this. And this is too bad that we cannot use this opportunity in a kind of creative way, with partnership, with everything, not with subjugation and slavery, but partnership. But right now things are not good. Maybe there was another person there, okay? And then you. Was there another person there? Now, let me be a bit. Have a kind of a provocation here, because all the questions are coming from the young people, professors. Would you have a question? No?
Who's a professor?
I don't know. I mean, you look like a professor.
I read one time where there was a pogrom in Poland after the end of World War II.
Yes.
Was this an isolated case, or were there pogroms also?
This is a very interesting story, because, as you know, Jan Gross, the guy who wrote The Neighbors, published recently another book under the title Fear, anti-Semitism in Poland after 45. And the book is devoted mostly to the Kielce pogrom of July the 4th, 1946. An interesting story and a difficult story. And we Polish people feel kind of bad about this for many, many, many reasons. I mean, this is a shameful story, no doubt about it. A local Polish population massacred the remnants of the Jewish community of Kielce. They killed 42 persons during a terrible pogrom. I mean, we cannot say anything which would, I don't know, justify this or do anything about this. But we feel unfair about the way this story has been portrayed by international media or international scholarship. Because, as you implied in your question, this was not an isolated case. Because anti-Semitism is not a Polish phenomenon. This is a European phenomenon. As a matter of fact, to be precise, anti-Semitism existed before the Polish nation was formed or appeared, right? Much stronger, much older than Poland itself. So this is not specifically a Polish issue. This is a European or Western phenomenon, anti-Semitism. And after World War II, there were anti-Jewish pogroms in many places in Europe, many places, not only in Kielce, Poland, but also in other countries too. And go to the Holocaust Museum, and I know this well because I spent several months over there as a scholar in residence. This is the name of this position. Go to the Holocaust Museum and take a look at the exhibition devoted to the post-war pogroms. Kielce, period, nothing more. In Slovakia, for instance, south of Poland, there were about 6 pogroms after the war. 2 in Bratislava, in Preszow, in Košice, in Topolčany. There were pogroms in the Soviet Union. There was even a riot in Munich. So, not an isolated phenomenon, not only in Poland, but yes, it took place in Poland, and this is a topic of an eternal debate in Poland. Who's responsible for this? Whose interest it was? Why did it happen? We deal with it, and I think it's good because some other people don't deal with this. So not an isolated thing, but again, you see, Gross wrote a very interesting book, and we just talked about this. The new book, Fear, is extremely interesting. It's a very good book. I mean, very good read. You read it, and you are really excited about this. But Gross and some American scholars have a kind of a peculiar attitude towards history. I mean, different attitude than European scholars, even though Gross is a Polish guy coming from Poland. Here in America, details are not that important in historical writing. The main message, the main idea is important and should be emphasized. As far as details are concerned, they don't really care. Gross uses constantly the word essay in subtitles of his books. It's a historical essay. And talking about the Kielce and this new book, very good book. But he calls Kielce pogrom, for instance, the largest pogrom in Europe in peacetime. The largest pogrom in Europe in peacetime. When I read it, I was shocked, because as a scholar specializing in Polish Jewish history or East European Jewish history, I know very well that there were pogroms like Odessa, 1906, 600 Jews killed. Płoskiriv or Płoskirów, 1,500 Jews, 2 days, etc., etc. So why this guy calls Kielce the largest pogrom of Europe in peacetime? And I asked him, I know him very well, he's my friend. I said, Janek, how could you do this? I mean, the largest pogrom, he didn't check it. Because from his point of view, this was not the most important issue. The most important issue was the Polish responsibility for Kielce, this gruesome story which took place in Kielce, and many smaller things, smaller in his opinion, remained unchecked. He didn't even check. So there is this question. But yes, you're right, this is a very, very serious issue, non-isolated, and there is a huge collection of books on Kielce pogrom, and this is a very, very shameful episode of Polish history, no doubt about it. You had a question. There is no chance whatsoever.
Exactly. So, if we didn't, Polish citizens didn't get their land back, if now our government would say, oh, now we are going to give back all the land to its previous owners, the whole Polish nation would really flip out. Because, it's basically half of Poland, and half of Poland was nationalized.
More than half.
Yeah.
More than half.
And then there are no chances. No. You cannot even get back.
To some extent, this would be even counterproductive if the Polish government returned Jewish property first. Can you imagine the reaction of all those people, Polish, German, Ukrainian, Belarusian, etc., if they were put on a back burner and the Jews would receive their property first? I don't even want to think about the consequences of this. And the main point of my argument this evening is, I guess, that this was a ruined country. Yes, the Jewish case, the Jewish fate was the worst, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And anybody who questions this is either not honest or stupid, simply. Who says, oh no, we suffered more or something. This is not serious. But it's very important to remember about this general context, that this was a catastrophe. And frequently it was so, and this is one of eternal questions, why didn't the Poles help? Very frequently they did not help because they were overwhelmed themselves, and they were fighting for survival as well, themselves. And thinking about their families, thinking about themselves, they didn't really want it to think about the Jews. Yes, there were Poles who disliked the Jews, simply. Of course they were. Like there were Frenchmen, Russians, Germans, or I don't know, Greeks who disliked the Jews. But I would say that majority, it was so that they didn't really like the Jews, but more importantly, they were overwhelmed. Because they were in the middle of this hell themselves. And this is it.
Well, thank you very much for coming tonight. Once again, I thank you for your questions. I think Professor Rubel did an admirable job of distilling 5 years of history, the most studied piece of our history, I think, into a 45-minute lecture. So thank you very much, Professor Rubel.
Thank you.